Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 22, The Elements of Material Creation, Text Number 17. Sarigado Prakriti Hyasya. Karya Karana Rupini Sattvadi Bhigna Dhate Purusho Vyakta Ikshati Sanghato Prakriti Rasya Karya Karana Rupini Sattvadi Bhigna Dhate Purusho Vyakta Ikshati Sarangada Prakriti Rasya Karya Karana Rupini Sadhadi Vigner Date Purusho Vyakta Ikshati Sarga of creation. Adho, in the beginning. Prakriti, the material nature. He, indeed, asya, of this universe. Karya, the manifest products. Karana, and subtle causes. Rupini, embodying. Sattva Adi Bhir, by means of goodness, passion, and ignorance. Gunai, the modes. Dattē, assumes its position. Purusha, the Supreme Lord. Avyaktaha, not involved in material manifestation. Ikshate, witnesses. Translation. In the beginning of creation, nature assumes, by the modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance, its form as the embodiment of all subtle causes and gross manifestations within the universe. The Supreme Personality of Godhead does not enter the interaction of material manifestation, but merely glances upon nature. Purport. The Personality of Godhead is not subject to transformation like the subtle and gross material elements. Thus the Lord is avyakta, or not materially manifest at any stage of cosmic evolution. Regardless of the specific method of cataloguing the material elements, the Lord remains the ultimate creator, maintainer, and annihilator of the total cosmic situation. Sarigada Prakriti Hasya Kariya Karana Rupini Sadhadi Bhigna Dhatte Purusho Vyakta Ikshati. In the beginning of creation, nature assumes, by the modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance, its form as the embodiment of all subtle causes and gross manifestations within the universe. The Supreme Personality of Godhead does not enter the interaction of material manifestation, but merely glances upon nature. So here we see that Krishna himself is explaining nature of material manifestation and his own paternal position. And here he's very clearly describing that he is, although he sets in motion the material manifestation by his glands, he is not one of the material manifestations itself. So he has a separate transcendental nature. So it's logical, of course, that if before the material manifestation there is a cause which creates the material manifestation, then that original cause must be being beyond, before material creation, it must be something that is not a material creation. If something exists before material creation, then we conclude that it's not a material manifestation. But there is no material manifestation at this point. So Krishna is saying that there is something before the material manifestation, and that transcendental element is the Supreme Lord. He has nothing to do with material manifestation. It's not possible that the transcendental cause of the material manifestation can be considered part of the material manifestation, because it existed previously. And so then one may consider, of course, here the word is used, Purush, or the Supreme Lord, the Supreme Person. Purush is usually has the connotation or the definition of a predominating personality, someone who predominates, whereas the material manifestation, which is described here as Prakriti, represents the predominated energy. So when we see those terms, Purush and Prakriti, we refer to the predominator, the enjoyer, that person. And when we refer to Prakriti, we refer to the energy which is predominated over by the Purush. We see in the Bhagavad Gita, of course, that the Krishna describes there are two Prakritis. There is Paraprakriti, which represents the individual spirit soul, and there is the material manifestation, which is another inferior form of Prakriti. But in either case, the Prakriti represents that energy which is enjoyed or predominated by the predominated personality. So in that sense, God is considered to be a male person. There are some, you know, people like to be politically correct these days. So even sometimes you hear that, you know, various priests or people who, you know, are speaking about religious matters, they say that God, the Father, or she, they say he or she, because they're trying to be politically correct. They don't want to offend women by saying that God is a male. So they say he or she, because of course they don't know. But the fact that this original entity is actually setting in motion and controlling the material manifestation, means that that supreme being is male, in the sense that that supreme being is the predominator and enjoyer. So that is the, in that sense, he is a male figure. So of course we know, we understand that God is a male figure, and that is Krishna. And of course we also understand that he manifests his transcendental, internal, spiritual potency as Srimati Radharani. So in that sense we can say that God also has the feminine counterpart, but we still consider that Lord Sri Krishna is the source of all spiritual and material energies, and always remains in the position as being the source and the controller of all energies. He is always the Purush, even though the female counterpart is there in the form of Srimati Radharani. So the feminine aspect of God is there, but the feminine aspect of God represents his energy, either material, spiritual, or marginal. And the male aspect of God represents, of course, the source of all energies. That is why the devotees of the Lord, they, you know, if you go to Vrindavan, of course, people will greet each other, and everyone, Jai Radhe, this. People are very, you go to Vrindavan, people are very Radharani conscious, because they know that this feminine aspect of the Supreme Lord, his spiritual energy, the full spiritual potency manifested as Srimati Radharani, by nature, the feminine nature is softer and usually more compassionate than the male aspect. And therefore, the devotees know the secret, that if you want to get the mercy of Krishna, the Supreme Person, that you approach Srimati Radharani, because she is very, you know, very soft-hearted, very compassionate. And also because she is so dear to Lord Sri Krishna, being his internal pleasure potency. She is the manifestation. Srimati Radharani, of course, is the manifestation, the personification of the highest form of love of Godhead. Krishna's Vadini Shakti personified. That Vadini Shakti manifests as Srimati Radharani, and the Radharani being the embodiment of Mahabhava, or ecstatic love of God to its highest degree. And the Vadini Shakti also manifests as the pastimes that are reciprocated between Lord Sri Krishna and Srimati Radharani. So these are the spiritual manifestations of the Vidini Shakti, or the Krishna's spiritual potency. So in this sense, although Krishna is the Purush, the predominator and the enjoyer, actually the devotees know the secret that Krishna, because of love, because of the manifestation of enjoying his Ladini Shakti, the pleasure potency, Krishna likes to be predominated by his devotees. So although he is the predominator and the enjoyer, he takes greater pleasure when his devotees take the role of being the predominator, and therefore Krishna becomes the servant and subservient and literally a plaything in the hands of his devotees. Therefore we see that you know, there's that pastime of where one brahmana was asked by his spiritual master to read the Bhagavad Gita every day, but of course that brahmana, he couldn't read, he was illiterate. So he would just because his spiritual master asked, so he read, and he was just making some sounds that, you know, wasn't really the Bhagavad Gita. And people would make fun of him, and sometimes they would ask him, you know, why are you reading the Bhagavad Gita like this? And he wouldn't really answer. He would just keep reading. Anyway, one day Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came along, and he saw, you know, here's this brahmana reading the Bhagavad Gita, you know, he has seen, and you know, obviously very you know, tearful and manifesting certain ecstatic symptoms. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu asked, you know, how is it that you are reading the Bhagavad Gita like this? And he replied, well, actually I cannot read the Bhagavad Gita, but my spiritual master ordered me to, but therefore I'm just making some attempt. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, but I see that you are shedding tears of transcendental ecstasy. How is that, that you cannot read and yet somehow you are in this transcendental position? And he explained that, yes, you know, sometimes there are tears. He said, that is because whenever I read the Bhagavad Gita or try to read the Bhagavad Gita, I remember that Lord Sri Krishna became the charioteer of Arjuna. That although he is the supreme Purush, the supreme enjoyer, the supreme Lord, the supreme predominator, the supreme controller who everyone should serve and does serve, either directly or indirectly, he, out of love for his devotee, he is driving the chariot and Arjuna is sitting on the seat. It should be Krishna who is sitting on the seat and Arjuna who is driving. But Krishna, out of friendship and out of love, and when I think of how so much love that the Lord has for his devotees, that he enjoys rendering them service, even though he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then tears come to my eyes. And Śrī Caitanya Mahāprabhu embraced him. You have actually understood the essence of the Bhagavad Gita. Okay. So sometimes, of course, some people, this is a very, very elevated understanding, that sometimes people read the Bhagavad Gita and they can barely even understand that they're not this body. They can barely get the beginning understanding of Bhagavad Gita. Some people read the Bhagavad Gita, they may understand that there is God, Krishna, and the living entities, but they still cannot distinguish that they are eternally, you know, individual. The Supreme Lord is eternally the Supreme Lord, and the living entity is eternally the living entity, and that the living entity never ever becomes God. Some people read the Bhagavad Gita and they may come to the correct conclusion that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There are many unlimited living entities, they are also spiritual by nature, and they all eternally serve the Supreme Lord. But this understanding of the Brahmana is even higher than that, and that is this bhakti yoga, which is the essence of the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita, is Krishna's teaching that one should take to bhakti yoga, and by bhakti yoga one can immediately capture the attention of the Supreme Lord, because he becomes captivated by that love. Therefore we see in the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, it describes that one who attentively hears this Srimad Bhagavatam, then immediately the Lord is captured within the heart, because this bhakti has that potency to immediately capture the attention of the Supreme Lord and initiate that loving reciprocation between the devotee and the Supreme Lord. Just the Lord is actually so pleased with his devotee that if he if one takes the trouble to hear Srimad Bhagavatam, then Krishna becomes very, very easily pleased by that, just by hearing. Especially if one hears the messages from Krishna's devotees. In fact, that's the only way that one can really capture the attention of Krishna. There must be bhakti. It's not a mechanical process that just by hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam one captures the attention of the Supreme Lord. It is when one hears and there is bhakti, and one is hearing from one who is speaking Srimad Bhagavatam, and speaking that Srimad Bhagavatam with bhakti or love and devotion for the Supreme Lord, then that hearing and chanting will capture the Supreme Lord. Just like there are in India, they have the Bhagavat Saptaha, where they will read the Srimad Bhagavatam imitating Parikshit Maharaj, and they will read the Bhagavatam for 7 days. They'll read the entire Bhagavatam. So those who are reciting the Srimad Bhagavatam, they're just thinking that they will make some profit, that it is a profession, that they will earn a livelihood by reciting Srimad Bhagavatam. And because they are doing a professional business, they don't care to make sure that the audience is actually understanding Srimad Bhagavatam, and that the Srimad Bhagavatam is affecting a change of heart in the people. They're not interested in that. They're interested that somehow or another I will attract them, and I will be a popular reader, and more people will come, and the more people will come, then the more money I will get, the more, you know, fame and reputation. So there's no bhakti there. And the people are also, they're coming and thinking, oh, this is a very pious activity. That, you know, so much sense gratification, sinful activity has been there. And in order to remove the obstacles so I can go on with my sense gratification without too much disturbance and increase my material existence nicely without disturbance from sinful reactions, then I will hear Srimad Bhagavatam, and by that piety I can go on like this. So neither both the hearer and the speaker, they come for 7 days, they hear and chant and then they go away. And they go back to the same sense gratification, the whole process of sense gratification, and they just go back to further sense gratification. Therefore, they're also hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, but because there's no bhakti there, it does not actually capture the Lord within the heart. Therefore, they cannot understand the Lord. And both the hearer and the speaker are just discussing Srimad Bhagavatam, and especially those parts of the Srimad Bhagavatam which deal with Krishna's Rasa Leela with the gopis, and they're considering that Krishna and the gopis are just like ordinary boys and girls, and this topics they find very attractive because it's it is something like their romantic sexual activities in this material world, and it gives them so many different ideas to increase their pleasure with their with the opposite sex. And therefore you see that many Indian movies, when they sometimes they bring Krishna into the movie, there's some love scene going on, you know. And the hero is, you know, reciting Srimad Bhagavatam, sometimes playing the flutes, you know, and by bringing in that mood of Krishna, it is creating a nice romantic, you know, atmosphere that he will get the girl, you know, like that. And she is, you know, reciting and doing different things that Radharani and the gopi do, and this is, you know, gradually ideas. So you quite often see different Indian movies like that, that, you know, when the romantic scenes come on, you know, the boy is trying to get the girl like that, then they bring in this Krishna and the gopis, because it sets a beautiful background, a romantic scene for their love life like this. So in the same way, when they read Srimad Bhagavatam, it is, you know, they're getting food for their romance and love life in the material world. So people find that very, very attractive. That's their main source of happiness in the material world. But actually, Srimad Bhagavatam, we see that Srila Prabhupada, he made a point that every day, we don't just jump forward, but that in the main thing was not racing forward to make a show of relishing this internal pleasure potency, display of the pleasure potency with Krishna's Rasa Leela, but actually making sure that people understand that God is an eternal transcendental person, and that we are his eternal servants. And therefore, verse by verse, one devotee asked Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, says in the beginning, I think it's in the preface, that by reading, through these 9 cantos of the Srimad Bhagavatam, one will be God realized. He said, what does that mean? Prabhupada says, what do you think it means? He said, you will see Krishna face to face. He said, no, you can see the deities. Krishna is there face to face. So many people have seen the deities. That is not it. He said, you know, at the end of reading the first nine cantos of the Srimad Bhagavatam, one who's God realized means that you understand that you're an eternal servant of Krishna. If you haven't got that by the end of nine cantos, you know, you've missed the whole thing. You know, and then you're racing into the Rasa Leela with Krishna and the gopis, and you still haven't understood that he is God and you're his servant eternally. So therefore, you know, every verse, Srila Prabhupada made sure that the proper understanding was there in each verse. And you know, if you go through Srila Prabhupada's lectures, you'll see that sometimes there are verses in the Bhagavatam which some devotees may take as almost like just a little stepping stone to the next verse, you know, and they quite often, or so sometimes, you know, devotees may go through many, many verses and then they find one that they'll sink their teeth into. But Srila Prabhupada, his recitation of Srimad Bhagavatam wasn't like that. Each and every verse, for Srila Prabhupada, each and every verse, you know, was a mine full of transcendental realization. And he wanted to make sure that the devotees, you know, fully understood the purport of that verse. You know, ultimately leading to always somehow or another demonstrating that we are the eternal servant of the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna, and that service is enacted through the process of bhakti yoga. You know, in every verse of the Prabhupada, you know, they show different aspects of this, and it is there. Prabhupada said that actually each and every verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam you can spend 1 month. Every single verse, you can spend 1 month on each of those verses. Right? And he said, therefore, there are 18,000 verses. So that will take you 1,500 years to complete your study if you do it properly. The Srimad Bhagavatam. And you know, to demonstrate that, of course, you know, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta, you know, he spoke on the first verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam. It was 3 months. Yeah. 3 months on the one verse. And when Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakura, of course, was in Vrindavan, all the local, you know, so-called Paramahamsas and Babajis and so-called advanced devotees, they all come to hear, oh, you know, great devotee has come, and you know, we would hear the nectarian pastimes of Srimati Radharani and the gopis and Krishna. And I think he spoke on the Ishapanishad. He spoke on the Ishapanishad every day at this. And then, you know, no one wanted to hear. They all went away. You know, and in fact, even the devotees, even some of his own disciples, then, you know, he would announce that today I am speaking again. And there is also Parikram. And so everyone went to the Parikram. Only, you know, a handful of people. Of course, we know that one of those handful of people was Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada stayed and he listened. And he admitted, just like the Brahmana in India who, you know, couldn't read the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada was something like that. He admitted, I couldn't quite understand what he was speaking about. But I listened. You see. And because he listened to the right person, and his intention was, you know, to sincerely try to understand the Supreme Lord by serving his devotee, by just hearing, even though he was really unable to understand, and that devotee was speaking to try and properly establish Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that we are his eternal servant. Therefore, the Lord was immediately captured within Srila Prabhupada's heart. And therefore, because the Lord was captured within his heart, Srila Prabhupada, because of that bhakti, we see that he manifested the full transcendental understanding of Krishna, Krishna's pastimes, bhakti, by hearing with the proper motive, and by hearing from the right person. Whereas, if people hear even Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, if the motivation of the hearing is there is no bhakti, and the speaker there is no bhakti, no understanding that of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then it will not produce the results. And one may say, but you know, how is that? Because the Srimad Bhagavatam is transcendental, we understand that it is so potent, it is not different from Krishna. But the example given by Sanatana Goswami is that if milk, sometimes if you feed milk and bananas to a snake, milk and bananas, of course, you know, is very, very good. But if you feed it to a snake, it just increases their poison. So in the same way, hearing and someone speaking the Srimad Bhagavatam without the proper motive to establish the supremacy of the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna and establish, help people to come to the platform of Bhakti Yoga as the eternal servant of the Lord to develop their love, to speak with any other motive, is like, you know, nectar touching the lips of a serpent, and it actually has a poisonous effect. And therefore we see that although many, many hundreds of Bhagavad Gitas were there when Srila Prabhupada came to America, they could not produce one devotee, but in fact those translations of the Bhagavad Gita prevented many people from becoming devotees, and are still reaping absolute havoc throughout the world. They have such a poisonous effect that just to make the heart very hard and materialistic, that once hearing those poisonous renditions of transcendental literature, it is very, very difficult to remove that poison from people's hearts and to convince them that they should take up bhakti yoga. Very, very, very poisonous. So that's very, very unfortunate. So here we see that Krishna is pointing out that he exists, he glances upon the material nature and sets into motion its interaction, and the material nature itself, which comprises of goodness, passion and ignorance, it creates its interactions and transformations create all the various subtle and gross manifestations within the material world. Just like an artist will take three different colours, three primary colours, yellow, red, blue, yellow, red, blue, and from those three colours then he can create the secondary colours, and then the tertiary colours, and all the in-betweens like that. And an artist with three colours, and then light and dark, just like we have light and dark, and there are three colors. He can create every single color within the material manifestation. An artist can take, a good artist can take those three colors, light and dark, and create all those different colors. And then he can take those colors and, you know, make all sorts of artistic creations, portraits, landscapes, seascapes, so many different things like that. And we can understand that the artist who is, you know, manipulating those different colors, just like an artist may do a self-portrait. So if an artist does a self-portrait, then one may think, oh, the artist has become a painting. Because within a self-portrait, of course, we see an image that has the you know, different qualities of the creator. And the material creation is like that. It has, because it has different qualities manifest from the creator, just like we see that Krishna is a person, you know, the Purush, male person, and therefore we see within the material manifestation that there are, you know, so many different male species of life. Like this, so we see that within creation there is a reflection of the creator. But an intelligent person can understand, of course, that, you know, within the portrait, the artist is not there. You know, he has to be separate, otherwise who's mixing the paint? You know, to mix the paint, we know that it's you have to, you know, put it on the palette, yet someone has to squeeze the tubes, someone has to take the lid off, you know, and you know, the arms in the portrait don't move, so who took the lid off? And who has, you know, put in their artistic flair? A portrait doesn't see, but someone who has created the portrait must be able to see, to be able to, you know, see this colour goes, this one doesn't, and then to put them all into the right places with the right, you know, translucent or, you know, different textures. So the person who has, we see that within the portrait, that although there is some similarity between the creation and the creator, not everything is there, because we see that whoever created the portrait must have vision. They must see, whereas the portrait has no vision. And in the same way, we see that all of the elements within, you know, material creation, none of the elements can see. They can't see. They're not conscious. You know, we take earth, water, fire, air, ether. None of them have consciousness. None of them can see. And none of the other elements can, you know, perform activities. Someone has to set them into motion. So we see that although there are some similarities between the creation and the creator, not everything is there. There are some distinct differences, that the creator has consciousness, has intelligence, has vision, has, you know, forethought, planning, skill, expertise, precision, and compassion. Otherwise, why even create the material manifestation? The material manifestation is created to give the tiny spirit souls the opportunity to fulfill their misused independence, to be imitate the Supreme Purush, although they're prakriti, the tiny spirit souls want to become the Purush. The spirit souls who are paraprakriti, they want to become the Purush or the enjoyer, but they're the enjoyer, they're the subordinated. So because to facilitate that the prakriti becomes an imitation Purush, an imitation God, then Krishna, out of his compassion, you know, he manifests the material world. So the creator also has compassion. But furthermore, the whole material creation is bringing back the prakriti, paraprakriti, to their senses, that they're not the enjoyer, but actually real transcendental pleasure lies in service. By enjoying a mood of unmotivated, pure, loving, devotional service in relationship to the Supreme Purush, then one automatically comes to the original position of transcendental bliss. One immediately becomes ecstatic, very happy. One is no longer trying to enjoy the limited contact of material senses with the material objects. Very, very limited and filled with material suffering. And we see the picture of Durga. Durga is the personified form of the material energy, and Durga actually expands from, she is Mahamaya, and Durga expands from Yogamaya, Krishna's spiritual potency, and she performs the thankless task of correcting or punishing the living entities, trying to bring them to their senses. Of course, that suffering within the material world is automatically there, because the material existence means that we can no longer experience transcendental happiness with our spiritual senses. So immediately we're already devoid of actual happiness by coming to the material world, because the spiritual senses are no longer experiencing transcendental pleasure in contact with Krishna, who is the reservoir of nectar. He is a personification of transcendental bliss. Just like, you know, if you meet a really happy person, always, you know, bubbling over with just joy and happiness, within a few seconds, even if you're depressed, automatically you begin, and you just feel happy, you know, in their presence. So Krishna is like that. He's an unlimited ocean of blissfulness and happiness. So in his association and the activities performed with that loving mood, where there is no birth, death, old age and disease, that's the real platform of happiness. And we come to the material world, everyone is depressed, everyone is morose, everyone is fearful, everyone is full of anxiety, everyone is envious. You know, sometimes you go into an office or factories, and you know, they have a big sign up, you know, because they're all working together. You've got 100 people in this factory and they have a big sign as soon as you walk in the door. It's hard to soar like an eagle when you're working with turkeys. So how can you be blissful? You know, you're stuck in this factory with a whole bunch of turkeys. They're all morose, they're greedy, they're miserly, they're angry, they're fed up. They're not intelligent. No, they're intoxicated. You know, like the previous night, they've had so much intoxication, they get up in the morning, they stumble out with a bit of burnt toast and, you know, a cup of coffee to get them going, and then you've got to associate with them all day. And they're like just completely in the mode of it. How much happiness and bliss. So it's not just that Durga, you know, punishing, is creating all the suffering. The very nature of material existence is suffering. Then there's punishment on top of that. And that punishment, we see that Durga, she rides on a tiger. So, and she is a beautiful form of Durga, and she has the trident. And, you know, the trident represents the threefold miseries. Adiyatmik, Adibhautik, Adidevi. And she's riding, and everyone, you know, all the so-called Purushas, all the so-called enjoyers, they're attracted to the beauty of, you know, the beautiful form of the woman. But they fail to see, you know, they're so enamored by Durga, you know, her beautiful form, that they're not looking, you know, the trident. An intelligent person, be, you know, forget the beautiful woman. What's that trident doing? You know, and what about the tiger? You know, how close am I going to get? You know, if you get past the trident, then you've got the tiger. And they're thinking, I'm going to enjoy it. This, the greedy. So, there was one poet, Tulsidas. Of course, you know, as Srila Prabhupada often pointed out, that, you know, everyone in this material world thinks they are the Purush, whether they are the men or the women. The women also think that they are the Purush, the enjoyer, and the men think that they are the enjoyer. And the women think that they are the enjoyer, and that the enjoyable is the opposite sex. And the men think, you know, the same. They are the Purush, the enjoyed, and the women are the enjoyed. So they're both thinking the same way. And the personification of that is, you know, this form of Durga sitting on the tiger with her trident. So there's one Vaishnava poet. His name is... I think it was Tulsidas, and he described that. Now he's talking about materialistic women, of course, you know, not devotee women. This Prabhupada, he told this story, and he very clearly made it understood that this does not refer to devotee women, but on a materialistic platform, and I think even the women will understand this. That his experience was that during the day, that women are like what they call dakshini, or like a witch, that they bewilder and you know, keep one under some sort of a spell. And at night they are like the, so that is like the beautiful form of Durga, and at night they are like the tiger. The tiger's business is sucking blood. That is the business of the tiger. So, you know, for the materialistic man, you know, they spent their enjoying sex life in the material world, but that sex life is literally draining them of their blood. And as we know, to, you know, I think it takes so many... so much blood create one drop of semen. This, you know, just so for men, this is why brahmachari ashram is so important, and because when men, if they train up as brahmacharis, then by the time they get married, their good health is set for life. You know, that's the strength, the inner strength, their intelligence. And just their ability to combat illness is set for life. Therefore, they're very strong, very active, very enthusiastic, very keen, you know. And then in marriage, they're also, you know, they have sex life for children, and therefore they also remain, you know, very powerful, you know, by, but the nature of Maya is that she makes you suffer, and the way that she makes you suffer is by, you know, taking your blood, and then there's so many diseases, and the intelligence is bewildered all the time, so you do so many, you know, materialistic people do so many foolish things, and they have no ability to understand, you know, Krishna consciousness, because they, you know, the brain is just being obliterated and dulled by just so much sex life. So this is the tiger that Durga is riding upon, like this. And then, because they are trying to enjoy the sex life, and the tiger is sucking the blood and destroying their intelligence, and then when then it brought them with the threefold miseries that then they're having to, you know, so many different forms of suffering. Now, this, that's a fact. So, but people cannot understand it. And they're taking that, oh, I am so happy. You know, like this. Why do I need God? I'm so happy. Drinking my own blood, therefore we see in the Bhagavatam that you know, materialistic men are considered to be like camels. The camel chews the thorn, all the blood comes in the mouth, and they think, oh, this is delicious. And they're not realizing, yes, it's delicious, you're chewing your own blood like this. So in this way we see that you know, those who still have intelligence in the age of Kali, they can understand through hearing from the Srimad Bhagavatam, from the devotees of the Lord, that they are not the Purush, but they are actually the Prakriti, or the spiritual being, eternal servant of Krishna, and that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So both the men and women, they do not consider themselves to be the Purush or the enjoyer of the material energy which causes so much trouble. Both the men and women in ISKCON, they're very intelligent, and they know that you know, by avoiding being attracted to the material energy, they save themselves so much trouble, and they maintain their good strength and their intelligence in order to always, you know, be very clearly Krishna conscious. And by being Krishna conscious throughout their life, and free from the tricks of Maya, they can think of the Supreme Lord at the time of death and go back to the spiritual world. So I'll just leave it there. If anyone has any comments or questions.
You're talking about how we should hear Bhagavatam Bhakti.
Yes.
How do we develop that?
One should hear very attentively, and make sure that one hears, you know, as we do, through the disciplic succession, coming through ISKCON, through Srila Prabhupada's books. You know, Prabhupada's books, as soon as you make a serious endeavor to read, reading is also hearing. You know, hearing from devotees is the best, but reading is another form of hearing. Except that it's difficult to then ask questions and, you know, get feedback and... you get a lot of benefit from the you know, hearing from the person Bhagavat, but still, so it's more difficult to make advancement just by reading, but still reading is very valuable, and it is another form of hearing and chanting, and by reading or hearing, then one catches the attention of Krishna, and that's when it's done with the service mood. So, you know, if we're hearing and reading with the mood of how I can become a nice devotee to serve Krishna like that, that's then even if we can't philosophically understand, Krishna becomes so pleased that he will appear, you know, within your heart with all the required understanding. Everything will manifest if you are hearing, nicely, attentively in the association of devotees with an attitude to how I can actually serve Krishna and, you know, free myself from this mentality of being the enjoyer of the material world. So reading and hearing in that mentality is everything becomes manifest here. But, you know, if we read and hear with the mentality that I will become a great scholar and, I will be known as a great pundit, and everyone in the temple will, you know, worship me, and I will be the enjoyer. You know, there can be subtle forms of maya, and that doesn't attract Krishna as much, but he still may give some credit for the fact that you're reading Prabhupada's books at least. Any other questions or comments? Any of the ladies? Haven't offended anyone over there. Go on, Rasa.
Information, apologize, I asked Pete to skip a couple of texts with my reports.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, but it's, sometimes I do that. That's funny, that's interesting. Yeah.
14.
That's, I was expecting to do 14 this morning, yeah.
Yeah, we did 40, we haven't read
15, 16, right, I see. I'll just read them quickly, or I might as well just read them, skip them. 15, 16, I'll just read them. We get the benefit. Shrotam Thagdasanam Grano, Jivati Gyana Saktaya, Vakpan Yupasta, Vyangri, Karaman, Angobayam Manaha. Hearing, touch, sight, smell, and taste are the five knowledge acquiring senses. My dear Uddhava, and speech, the hands, the genitals, the anus, and the legs constitute the five working senses. The mind belongs to both these categories. Middle purport. 11 elements are mentioned in this verse. Text 16. Sabdaha spasho raso gandho rupam chittata jaktaya gachukta utsagha shilpani karmayatana siddhaya. Sound, touch, taste, smell, and form are the objects of the knowledge acquiring senses and movement. Speech, excretion, and manufacture are functions of the working senses. Little purport. Here the word utsaga refers to evacuation by the genitals and anus, and it thus constitutes two elements. In this way, 10 elements are listed here in two sets of five. I'm not sure what the standard is there, because I know that some older devotees, if there's no purport, they'll say, don't write that verse up and write the next one up that's got a purport. So some of the sannyasis do that. And, my personal preference is that they actually write up the next verse and the devotee recites it, and then they just read through to the... Otherwise, what happens, to my view, is what happened today is you can skip a lot and no one knows. And that's different to the way the Prabhupada wanted us to go through. So thanks for mentioning that. Yeah. Sorry, we'll go to the Prabhupada.